Thank you, Matt. Thanks very much for the invitation. It's really nice to be back at BI. So 4 years, this year 2008, 11 and 12, and it's been a while since then. Right, so to get straight to it, the talk is going to be sort of an overview of three different projects that I'm doing with a number of different people. As you can see, I've listed all of my collaborators. But they're all related to essentially the question of how accurate can finite dimensional quantum systems be at measuring time or encoding information about time or using information about time to control a process on an external system. And the three projects go about this very different ways. So to begin with, just a little bit about what a clock has to be, essentially. So to begin, I would like to say that this talk will not go into the fundamental nature of time and such foundational questions in quantum mechanics. It's more assuming quantum mechanics, assuming just simple non-relativistic, the Schrodinger equation, how well can we measure time with quantum systems. And the two main properties of a clock, from that perspective, is that first, they must encode something about the parameter t, which we see in Schrodinger's equation, because it's written with respect to differential in time. So that's the first thing. And the second thing is that it must write this information on an external system. So this could be either a memory or an external control. And we will get into that a little bit more as the talk goes into in. And at this point, you can see immediately why a quantum system will be different from a classical system. And for two major reasons. The first is the reason that pops up in all of quantum mechanics, which is the measurement disturbance. If you measure a quantum system, you disturb it. So it is very possible that a quantum system that is being used as a clock, every time it provides its this information to an external system, you will disturb it and therefore degrade the performance of the system as a clock. But the second interesting difference of quantum clocks is the finite dimensional nature. So one looks, if one were to gaze at the clock on the wall, in this case it's also discrete, but if instead you imagine that the clock on the wall was just a particle going around in a circle, there would be essentially, in classical physics, an infinite number of states that the particle goes through, and therefore you could encode an infinite amount of information. It just would only depend on how accurately you could measure the position of the particle. But if you consider a quantum system, which is finite dimensional, and it has only a number of states that it can go through before perhaps returning, then in essence, there is a finite amount of, the only information you have are the number of states that are available to you. So there is a finite amount of information about time that can be stored in it. And this also introduces the notion of discontinuity, which is the fact that when evolving from one state to another in quantum mechanics, if you assume just Hamiltonian evolution, so just unitary evolution, a quantum mechanical state cannot jump discontinuously from one state to the other. If it is to go from, if we label this state 1 and 2, if between going from state 1 to state 2, it must pass through a mixture or a superposition of the two states. And this is another difficulty in quantum clocks, because it means that there must be an inherent uncertainty. Even if you were to measure in this basis of states that the clock passes through, the information that you get will not be a perfect encoding of background time. It will be inherently uncertain with respect to background time. So in order to sort of gauge how these different problems appear in quantum clocks, I will introduce a scenario that was talked about by a group in ETH Zurich, notably Sandra Rankovic, Renato René, and Yongcheng Liang, which is to consider the question of clocks as just objects that do global ordering. So for example, what you would like to know is if there are a number of events that take place in time, you would only like to know which events took place in which order. So just a global ordering for events. And in order to study this process, they considered what they call the alternate ticks game, which is very simple. You have a referee in the middle, and you have your two clocks, A and B. And the clocks have only one goal. They have to provide what we would call ticks to the referee. So this could be, say, intermittent release of photons to the referee. And the only constriction, the one of two constrictions is, in order for the game to be successful, the ticks have to be alternate. So every time, between every two consecutive ticks from system A, there must be a tick from system B, and vice versa. If at any point one of the systems gives two consecutive ticks without the other one ticking, then the game is lost. So this is the alternate ticks game. And the second constriction is has to do with continuity. The game must be designed in such a way that the measurement of by the referee on the either the systems or on the tick registers must not be of the sort that can cheat. It must not be of this. It not be the sort of measurement that can in fact encode time and it provide temporal information on its own. And what this basically means is that the evolution of the clocks has to be continuous. It has to, if you split it up into very small steps, it would have to be that they were very close to identity. There could not be a very big change in. Yes?
Can the referee receive two photons at a time?
No, that would also be a loss in the game, yeah. So the way the game would go, perhaps, is that the referee, in every step, just applies a map on both A and B, and one of the outcomes of the map, it would be sort of a measurement map, one of the outcomes would correspond to a tick of that clock. So in order to win, they couldn't tick at the same time. It just has to be alternate. But in fact, that corresponds to a very unlikely scenario because the condition of continuity means that the referee should be able to split these maps into very, very small portions, which means that each application of the map is very close to identity. So the likelihood of both of them ticking at the same time becomes very small.
But, so how would you define state simultaneously?
Well, it just each step of the game would be the referee applying the map on both the clocks. So if in that step both of them ticked, then that would be a simultaneous tick. And essentially, the referee would have with him, you could imagine, just two long bit strings and zero corresponding to a tick from one side and one corresponding not tick. So something like this, 0, 1. At this point, this would be a fail. And if this was 0 or if this was 1, doesn't matter, this would be a fail because it would have been simultaneous or non-consecutive. Right.
The referee has a clock of their own.
No, that's very important because
what does it mean then? How do they decide when?
So it's not. So there are two ways to construct the game. The first is you could construct that the referee doesn't decide anything; just these two clocks are responsible for sending photons, in which case he doesn't have to decide. The other one is to remove the Hamiltonian evolution and consider that nothing happens on the system until the referee applies the map. So the evolution of the clocks then is encoded in the map that the referee applies. And then the only constriction is that the map is to be very close to identity. So. But possibly.
There's nothing that determines if the referee keeps applying this map.
Yes.
There's no definite interval between the applications?
No, that doesn't. So this is the picture in which there is no evolution of the clocks other than the map. So there's no internal evolution. It's just it's only in the map. So, yes?
So, yeah, just this the same line of thinking. So, you're presupposing an ordered sequence of measurements from the referee, and this is somehow what you're trying to get out. You're trying to get an order for events, but you already have the referee. The referee's events are presupposed to be ordered?
Yes.
Why isn't it circular? That's the.
Well, so the major constraint comes from the fact that the referees, the maps, have to be very close to the identity. So on either side, so the if you just write the map on the system A and the system B has to be very close, and the technical constraint is by the Diamond norm on states, has to be very close to just the identity map on row A, tensor row B. So for example, one way of cheating would be if you imagine that these two are bits, are qubits, for example, and this starts in the state 0 and this starts in the state 1. The referee could effectively, in each step, measure the state and flip it. And if the state was in 1, he writes a 1 and takes 0. And in that sense, the game would go on forever, and and you would win the alternate game forever. But of course, that map is very different from the identity, because in every state, you flip it. And in order for the map to be very close to continuous, in every stage of the game, the state would only be changed by an epsilon amount. But the map has, I should have also mentioned that the map has to be the same. It's not that you can apply a different map in every step. That's actually critical. It's the same map on the quantum system every single step. So these two constraints, if you sort of follow the details, will constrain there to be not, there won't be any cheating possible. If you write that this has to be closer to identity by epsilon, then the amount you can cheat essentially is related to that epsilon. And then the question is, if you make epsilon as small as you like, can you still get any, or can you get any rate of success from this game? So I hope I've explained it, but it is not, I mean, this project is really not mine, it's by the three authors I mentioned there, so I was just trying to introduce the scenario as best as I could. So they have, well, they studied the scenario and they showed that it was very indicative that if the system is finite dimensional, then the number of ticks you could obtain would be related to the dimension, and they have some numerical results to suggest that it looks like something that could be proportional to dimension or slightly greater. And this is where the first of the results that I'll talk about comes in. So I'm going to introduce a certain quantum system that you would think would be able to play this game. So consider the this is the Hamiltonian that is mentioned due to Salica and Wigner, and also studied quite a bit by Perez. And the system is very simple. The Hamiltonian is just a bounded harmonic oscillator. So equally spaced energy states. And if you have such a Hamiltonian, you can write a mutually unbiased basis with respect to the energy states that are essentially coherent superpositions of all of these states. So, right? And they are labeled by k. And the property of these states, which I would call time states for the rest of the talk, is that the Hamiltonian rotates each state to another. Therefore, if you start in theta 0, then after a fixed period of time, you go into theta 1 and so forward until finally you end up at theta 0 back again. This would be theta d minus 1. And the time period, of course, since I haven't put any omega, the time period is just 2 pi. But in general, if you put an omega, it'll be 2 pi by omega. So this is a nice system because it's effectively the quantum analog of a clock on the wall. It has states from 0. This is something of the order of d over 2. And it just goes through all of these states. So now you could consider that you could use this clock to play the game as follows. So each of the clocks is just this system. And in every application of the map that the referee does, he shifts the clock via it's the usual Hamiltonian evolution by a very small amount, after which he applies a weak measurement to check if the clock is in some region of the angle states, maybe of the time states. You could imagine that the region is just the state d over 2, so theta d over 2. So he checks whether the clock is in the state theta d over 2. Now, it's very critical that in order to obey the continuity condition, both the natural evolution step has to be very small, as well as the measurement has to be very weak. Because if either of these two things are not true, you would disobey continuity, and then you might as well find another way in which you can cheat. So if you do this, you could imagine that clock A, for example, begins here, and clock B begins here. And every time they pass through the measurement region, they will provide a tick. Clock B, of course, first, then clock A, and so on and so forth. And so this seems to be a natural candidate to play the alternate ticks game. And now the question is, how long will they be able to play before they fail? Yes?
If it's just a weak measurement, can't it just pass through the over 2 and not?
Yes, it can. And that will contribute to a rate of failure. So what you would ideally like is that the steps as well as the strength of measurement both go to zero, but the frequency of it happening goes to infinity in such a way that the probability of it ticking stays finite. So this is related to sort of a limit. If you make the strength, there are two parameters. One is the strength of the measurement, and one is the frequency of application of the map. And you have to be careful not to get into the limit where nothing happens, as well as not to get into the limit where you have Zeno's paradox, where the measurement's strong. But there is a region in between where the total probability of the click happening will be finite. Not one, because if the only way to make it one would be to make it really strong, and then that would create Zeno's paradox, but can be finite. Yeah. And in any case, what I will argue next is a sort of a best case scenario. So even if you take the scenario of it failing because it didn't even tick at all, you can still bound how well it can do. So that's an added cause of failure, essentially. Yeah. Yes, so the argument for how to bound how well this clock can do is very simple. Essentially, every time the clock ticks, for simplicity, what I will assume is that every time the clock ticks, it's reset to a standard state in the beginning. So for example, when A or B tick, they are reset to the state 0, right opposite, so that it will take another amount of time before it ticks again. So this is sort of a reset model. The clock goes on as long as the measurement outcome says no tick, it's just its natural evolution. And when the measurement outcome says there's a tick, it gets reset to a fixed state in order for it to continue again. And the point is, it's very easy to see where the error in the clock is going to arise from. Because effectively, the clock, being a quantum state, cannot jump into this region and out of this region precisely. It has to spend some time building up to be a superposition of something outside this region and something inside this region, to being totally inside the region and then being outside. And that is going to be uncertain by an amount that is the width of the clock state as it reaches this region. And even if you assume the best case scenario, which is actually not possible, but even if you assume that the clock stays precisely between two states at any given time, so at some point it's only at 0, then it will only be between 0 and 1, then only at 1, which is not possible because it in fact spreads more than that. But even if you assume the best case scenario, it means that the tick itself is always going to be of the order of one step uncertain in the evolution of the clock, which means that you can look at this now as a very simple thing. You have you can call them Alice and Bob. They start on opposite sides of a circle, and every now and then they will provide a tick to the referee. But every time they provide a tick, they also get an uncertain kick, which is of order 1. If you assume that there are d steps in between them, so d by 2 on this side, d by 2 on the other side, every time they give a tick, they get uncertain by order 1. And now the question of how long it will take the clocks to fail is very simple. You just have to find out how long it takes such that these kicks on Alice's and Bob's side will join together to make essentially the probability distribution of them on the circle overlap, in which case one of them might tick twice in a row because one of them has overtaken the other. And this is very simple to calculate. So we know that if in every step it gets a kick of order 1, then in n steps, the uncertainty is of order square root of n. So delta becomes square root of n. And therefore, the amount of time before they become uncertain enough that they overlap will be that square root of n must be of the order of steps in between them, which is d, which means that n is going to be of the order of d squared. So effectively, you would expect that the number of ticks that this clock could provide before they fail, in the sense that they give consecutive, one of them gives consecutive ticks, is of the order of d squared at the most. And this is a very, very much best case scenario, because as you pointed out, it assumes that you will always stick when going through the region, which is not always the case. It also assumes that you remain perfectly between any two states, which is also not the case. But even with those best case scenarios, just because of the continuity of quantum evolution between in going into the measurement region and going out of the measurement region, you already get a constraint that n must not be better than d squared. Right. Is that okay? Right. So the next thing I'll do is to propose a particular, well, to try and saturate this bound, essentially. Because now that we have a bound, it's not, because we took so many best case scenarios, it's not even clear that quantum mechanics will saturate this bound. It could be fundamentally worse. So the first obvious candidate to saturate this bound is to actually start the clocks in these time states, because they appear, well, they essentially begin in a definite, at a definite point, so they seem to be the best candidates. However, they don't do that well, because these states have, of course, we know that in between theta naught and theta 1, the state is going to be a mixture of many different thetas. And the question is, how big a mixture? How much does the state spread in between these definite points. And one can calculate this numerically, and you can see that the average variance of the state as it evolves, the average variance over the theta basis, is actually of the order of square root of d, which is quite remarkable. It means that even if you start in a fixed theta, which is variance zero by definition, the average variance that it has on its way to get to theta one is of the order of square root of d states, which means that when this goes through the measurement region, the tick, when the tick happens, has to be uncertain by the order of square root of d, because that's how much the state is spread on average as it approaches the measurement region. And if delta is of the order of square root of d, then you will have that square root of n times square root of d, which is the width of the packet after it has provided n ticks, should be of the order of d in order to fail, by the same argument as before. Before we had a kick of order 1, now we have a kick of order square root of d, and this gives n just being of the order of d, so just linear in dimension. So clearly the time states are not the best possible states to use for this clock. You'd need something better. And this takes us to, another result. So this is work with Misha Woods and Jonathan Oppenheim, where our original motivation was to find a quantum clock that could do a unitary accurately. And in fact, Misha spoke at PI in January about this. And the result was that we found a state that mimics the ideal clock. And as a slight diversion, let me say what the ideal quantum clock would be. So as I said, the what you would require an ideal quantum clock to do would be to encode the background time t. And there is a Hamiltonian that does this. So if you take the Hamiltonian h is equal to p, where p is just your standard momentum, this is in fact a perfect clock in the sense that if you calculate the rate of change of the x degree of freedom, so x dot, which is proportional to the commutator of x with the Hamiltonian, this will just be 1, ignoring all of the h bar constants and stuff. So this is the ideal quantum clock. Of course, this is not actually a physical clock, because as has been pointed out many times, in order to have this commutation relation be true, you would need that h is unbounded from below, which is exactly the property of momentum. Unlike momentum squared, momentum does not have any bound below. So it turns out that even though it is impossible to have exactly this sort of clock, it is possible to choose a particular state for the Salica-Wigner Hamiltonian that has the same properties as any wave function would have for the P clock. And the state is very simple. It is a Gaussian distribution, a coherent Gaussian distribution about the time states. So what you would take is some sort of state that looks pi sigma squared. And this would be psi. So this is not a time state. It is also not an energy eigenstate. It is something in between the two. It is sort of a coherent superposition of many time states. And this parameter sigma is important, because sigma is essentially the width with respect to the time states of that function. If sigma goes to 0, you get just a time state once again. If sigma goes to infinity, you end up with an energy eigenstate, because you end up with a coherent superposition of all of the time states, an equal superposition, which by definition is the inverse of this relation, which gives you back an energy state. The energy states and the time states are related by the discrete Fourier transform and the inverse discrete Fourier transform. So, right. And the property of this particular superposition is that, and what we've calculated, is that in fact it moves if I just unwrap the circle and just write a few of these points, this state corresponds to something like a Gaussian through the thing. And the property of such a state is that you can show that the evolution of the state under the Hamiltonian is as if you had the background state that was just moving continuously, and at any point of time, the actual state in this basis would just be the sampling of that background continuous function. So it's sort of, you recover quasi-continuity. It's as if you had the P Hamiltonian where there was just a wave function that was moving continuously in time. Of course, when I say quasi-continuous, what I mean is that the statement is true, but up to a certain error. You can calculate that the error in the state as it approximates this continuous evolution is, and I call this epsilon, is linear in the time, meaning it grows in time, but it's exponentially small in the dimension of this of the clock. So in other words, you have a state that approximates the ideal clock for discrete and finite dimensional Hamiltonians, and the error in that approximation is linear in time and exponentially small with the dimension. This actually, so I will put in a power alpha here. This parameter alpha depends on how you choose the width of the clock. If you choose the width sigma to be of the order of square root of d, which is right in the sort of in between having a time state and an eigenstate. A time state corresponds to sigma being 0, and an eigenstate corresponds to sigma being of the order of d. So if you choose sigma to be square root of d, then this is just exponential pi d over 4. If instead you choose sigma to be thinner or wider, then this power gets smaller. So the best case is really where this is just pi d. In fact, if you choose sigma to be thinner, what you end up is with d to the, well, you end up with something of the order of sigma squared. So if sigma is square root of d, then this is just d. If you try to make sigma smaller, then the error becomes worse with respect to d. But what you can show effectively with this error is that if you use such a clock and you try to make it as small as possible so that the error is still small, does not become too large, you can saturate the d squared bound for the number of alternate ticks. But this is a very, very asymptotic result in the sense that you need a very high dimension to actually see the d squared dependence, because for small dimensions, if you try to use a state that is too thin, it will act like a time state and will just spread a lot. But in the limit of very high dimensions, you can get n is equal to d squared. So you have a quantum state that essentially seems to saturate the bound for how well you can do at the ticks game. Right. So that's one part of the talk. And I'll come back to the role that coherence plays. Just to note that both the Hamiltonian is well, it's not stochastic evolution, so it involves coherence. And the state is also a very coherent distribution. But I will come back to this after contrasting this with the case of another clock that is actually quite incoherent. So. Yeah.
It's just evolving.
Yeah, sorry. It is evolving, but you can. The nice thing about the result that we have on the evolution of the clock is that you can model the weak measurement by an imaginary potential, essentially. So you can model it as the Hamiltonian plus the measurement can be modeled by h plus iv, essentially, where the iv corresponds to the weak measurement part. And this is only because of the fact that it's a weak measurement. So in the limit where the frequency goes to infinity and the step size and measurement strength go to zero, this becomes an exact result. And because we've essentially, I should say that the result that we have that it evolves continuously is not only for just the Hamiltonian, but also if you add a potential to the Hamiltonian, and then the error goes as still the same thing, but you have something that depends upon the steepness of the derivatives of the potential. So if you try and put a very strong measurement in here, then the error goes up. But for the strength of measurement that we require to play the alternate ticks game, it is possible to calculate that the error is still asymptotic, well, exponentially small in dimension. So, but thanks for pointing that out. I didn't mention that. Yeah.
And also, do you know how large d has to be?
To see it. Well, so for example, if you just look at this error term to see how high it is, if you choose sigma to be square root of d, so you choose a state that is square root of d large, then you can see the exponential dependence of the error already at d is of the order of 8 or 10, for instance. But if you try to make sigma to be much smaller, and you need sigma to be very thin here, because we know that if sigma is of the order of square root of d, then we get a tick that is a square root of d, and you get d, not d squared. So you need sigma to be of order 1. But already, numerically, we saw that if sigma was d to the 1 over 4, for example, so instead of square root of d, you needed d to be in the order of hundreds, like 200 or 300, to see the fact that the error is actually exponential. Because before that, the coefficients multiplying all of these were dominating. So really, it's a proof of principle to saturate n is d squared rather than actually...
100 is not that large a number.
No, I don't know. I'm not sure experimentally how viable it is or it isn't. So I wouldn't be able to comment on how large that would be. But it is a very coherent state. That's the only requirement. But yeah, I wouldn't comment on how physically viable it is. But. Yes. Okay. So. Right. So now to go to a related question is. How would you imagine creating a clock that ran autonomously? And what I mean by autonomous clock, a clock that you constructed only out of connections to various thermal baths that was able to provide information about time essentially forever. Is it possible to do this? How would you do it? And if you did it, what would the clock look like, and what would be the constraints on such a system? So imagine the following. So the idea is the following. So you just have some, let's call this room temperature. So you have a room temperature bath. You have a hot bath that is the source of your work. And this is going to be your clock. And there is some internal Hamiltonian evolution. And the result of the entire evolution is that this clock does exactly what your system A and B were supposed to do there, provide ticks with certain frequency at certain points of time. So one simple way of doing this would be the following, and this is I'm going to use the model for a heat engine that was proposed by Paul Skripczyk, Sandu Popescu, Nicola Brunner, and Noah Linden in Bristol. I think it was more than 5 years ago or so. And it was very simple. So you had a 3-qubit machine. This connected to the hot bath. It's connected to the room bath, and the rest was just a ladder. And this is E hot, E room, and E of, let's call this W, such that E hot would be E room plus E W. And there was the interaction that effectively every time an amount of energy was taken from the hot bath, it would be dumped into the room and the ladder. So it would be of the sort of 1, 0, n, with 0, 1, n plus 1, plus complex conjugate, summed over n. It's effectively, the hot loses energy and these gain, or the complex conjugate term, where the hot gains and these two lose. And by choosing the temperatures of the hot and the room bath, you can effectively bias this process to be in one direction more favorably than the other. This is effectively just choosing the temperature so that this acts as an engine, effectively. And by doing so, you can essentially push this system up an energy ladder. And now to turn this into a clock, all you have to consider is that at some point, let's say the top of the ladder or above a certain region of the ladder, some states are unstable, and they decay and emit photons or some sort of radiation that can be detected, after which it returns to a fixed state on the ladder. And this would be an easy way to construct a clock. Essentially, you have an engine that is continuously raising a ladder. Every now and then, after it reaches a certain point on the ladder, it ticks, comes back down, and repeats this forever, essentially. And doing this would essentially make an infinite source of ticks. Not with perfect accuracy, which we'll come to, but it would be, in some sense, a clock, because you could essentially calculate what the average time from the bottom to the top was and what the average error from the bottom to the top was. So this is, it's a proposal for an autonomous clock, effectively. And the key quantities that we are interested in, so maybe I'll erase this now. in the case of the autonomous clock, is one is the resolution, which is the number of ticks that the clock provides per unit time. The second would be the accuracy. And there are many ways to define this, but I'll define it in a very similar way to the alternate ticks game, which will be the number of ticks that this clock and another clock of the same design could provide alternately until they fail, which is exactly like the alternate ticks game. And the third, which is the thermodynamically relevant quantity, is the dissipated heat. Because every time the clock runs, there is some heat that is thrown into the room temperature bath that is irretrievably lost. And so this corresponds to somehow the thermodynamic cost of each of the ticks that the clock provides. And what you would like to see is whether there is some sort of fundamental constraint between the resolution, the accuracy, and the dissipated heat. And so the interesting thing is, looking at the results of the heat engine paper that introduced this model, they already found that when you start from some fixed state on the ladder, as you moved up, if you considered that the energy of the ladder, and we'll call this dE average over dt, was a constant, they found that this is some constant k, constant. But essentially, they also found that as you move up the ladder, the spread in the state, because clearly there are two competing terms here. One is the probability of moving up. The other is the probability of moving down. So it's sort of a combination of, it's like a biased random walk. And because it's like a biased random walk, you find that the e squared minus the uncertainty in the energy as it moves up was essentially of the order of square root of the average energy as it moves up. So if you started with it in a precise energy, as it moves up, the uncertainty and the energy would be of the square root of the height that it had moved up. Okay? And this is essentially the principle of the random walk. As you go to the random walk, if you have a biased random walk, the average goes as the number of steps, but the uncertainty goes as square root of the number of steps. So, and this immediately tells you, well, sort of hand-wavingly, what the answer to this, the accuracy, is going to be, because we know that the uncertainty in the tick is essentially the width of the packet as it approaches the region in which it's going to tick. So if it's going to be, so when it reaches, it takes d steps, we know that by this result, the uncertainty has to be square root of d, and this gets us back to the sub-optimal result. If the uncertainty of square root of is of square root of d, then the number of ticks before it fails is going to be of order d. And this is sort of fundamental, because I wrote this in terms of a three-qubit interaction. But effectively, if you consider that all you have is just a ladder and a stochastic matrix that tells you how the ladder evolves, and by stochastic, I mean it's just a combination of probabilities of moving up and down on the ladder, then it must be that the number of ticks before this fails to be a good clock is going to be of order d, because all stochastic evolution does is just provide a biased random walk. And this is at this point I would like to point out the difference between this evolution and the evolution of the Salica-Wigner clock with the state that we had chosen. It seems that coherence is necessary to get the quantum bound of d squared, because without coherence, in the state and in the Hamiltonian evolution, you would just have a stochastic walk. And from the arguments of random walks, you can see that the number of ticks you get is only d. And this is reminiscent of the Heisenberg limit. It may, in fact, be just an equivalent statement of the Heisenberg limit. I'm not very well versed with this, so I wouldn't be able to comment. But it's quite possibly related to that.
What's the Heisenberg limit?
So the Heisenberg limit has to do with the measurement of phase. Well,
so on an principle for phase versus number.
Yes. Well, I'm not sure whether that's the same thing as you said. But it essentially says that if you use a measurement that is a coherent measurement on many particles rather than just measurements, repeated measurements on various particles on their own, you can get a square root of n increase in the accuracy of the measurement.
Okay.
And this is seems of, well, to be very similar, because you get essentially a square root of d improvement in the accuracy of every single tick, which is what gives you the difference between d and d squared. Right. So the final thing to note then is, okay, so we know that it's going to be of the order of d because the answer d in each tick is of the order of square root of d. However, there's going to be a coefficient that is coming in the front of square root of d, and this coefficient depends on how biased this ladder is. Because a biased random walk has two components. One is the probability of moving forward, one is the probability of moving back. If you try to operate this engine at the Carnot limit, which is the reversible limit where the power essentially is zero, then the probability of going up would be exactly the same as the probability of going down, which means that the uncertainty then, by the time you actually spread to that level, is actually off the order of the dimension, because there's no bias to going up as opposed to going down. So clearly, you need power to bias this in one direction more than the other. And the only way to bias it entirely in one direction would be to have infinite power. That's the only way you could bias it entirely in one direction. And so if you calculate for this model, and just with the notion of just a stochastic ladder and the properties of how thermal baths can create temperatures on transitions, this is related to the virtual qubits, which I won't go into, you can find a very nice relationship between the accuracy and the power, which looks something like by power, I mean the dissipated heat in every single tick. So every time the clock provides a tick, the amount of energy that has gone into the room temperature bath. And this is less than one. And well, the thing itself looks complicated, but you can easily see two regimes. One is the regime where the dimension is very high. So if D is high enough, if D is high, then you can calculate that the accuracy is essentially linearly related to the power. So it's just proportional to the power. And on the other hand, if the power is high, then the accuracy is essentially the dimension with some small correction. So essentially what it means is that if you have very high power, then you recover the results that we've already argued for, that the number of ticks is bounded by the dimension. But if you do not have high enough power, then you don't even get to the dimension, you get into something that's just linearly related to the power. So effectively what it means is that the power and the dimension are activators for each other. Having one very large but not the other is essentially no point, because you're bound by either of them. And it's quite interesting. It's a three-dimensional graph, so I cannot draw it. But if you plotted the accuracy versus power and dimension, you essentially see a sort of a slope on one side and a slope on the other side, corresponding to when the dimension is high and the power is the only relevant quantity, and when the power is high and when the dimension is only the only other the quantity. So this sort of gives you a trade-off between power and accuracy for autonomous clocks. I think that was all I had to say. I don't have slides, so maybe I'll summarize in words everything that I wanted to say. The concept of quantum clocks is that you need a system that encodes the background time in the Schrodinger's equation, and also an external system, which could be either memory or a control system that you write the information on, because on its own, the information is useless. And this provides a clear contrast with classical mechanics, because in the process of writing this information on an external system, which is going to be like a measurement, you are going to be disturbed, and therefore the clock is going to degrade. And the second big difference is that because if you have a finite dimensional quantum system, because you have a finite number of states the clock can move through, the amount of information that can be encoded is finite, unlike a classical variable which can have a continuum of states. If you try to use a scenario like the alternate ticks game, which fortunately we've erased by now, to calculate how well a quantum system can do, it becomes clear that it is related to the dimension of the system, because since quantum evolution is continuous, you're going to have that every time the clock provides a tick, just like a normal clock on the wall which provides ticks, it gets a disturbance that is related, is of unit one in the Hilbert space of the clock. And the Hilbert space of the clock being of dimension d, from that you can calculate that the best a quantum clock could ever hope to do is of order d squared. So a quantum clock of dimension d would be able to, along with its identical copy, provide d squared alternate ticks before it must fail. And it is possible to find something that asymptotically approaches that bound of d squared, which incidentally is not a fully coherent superposition of all of the energy states, which is what one would typically pick for these the particular Hamiltonian that I've demonstrated here, but in fact a Gaussian distribution over such states. And the property of such a Gaussian distribution is that not just in the alternate tick scheme, but in its natural evolution, it approximates what you would expect from the ideal momentum clock, in that the evolution is as if there was a background continuous wave function that moved, and at any point of time, the state was just a discrete sampling at certain points. And yes, so with that, you can get d squared. But if instead you try to construct an autonomous clock, one that did not require an external source of work or an external reset like I considered in that model, that was constructed just out of connections with thermal baths, then you can argue that the number of ticks, once again, is suboptimal. It can only be d, because in fact, all such a thermal clock will do is provide a stochastic evolution, which in the end looks just like a biased random walk. And by definition, that would only give you d ticks. And in addition, in order to optimize that suboptimal bound itself of dimension d, you would need infinite power. If instead you had a finite amount of power, you can find that there is sort of a trade-off between the power and the accuracy. Not a trade-off, essentially, a dependence. The higher the power, the higher the accuracy you can get. If you have high enough power, then you do saturate the dimensional bound. If you do not have high enough power, then effectively your accuracy is just linearly related to power, which means that the dimension of the system and the power activate each other in terms of the accuracy of the clock. And yeah, that's all. Thank you.
You look at that cloud.
Yes.
You have an idea what is deep for that cloud?
Oh.
How long can it run?
Too large. I don't know. It's too large, but probably I don't know what d is for that clock, but probably the accuracy is quite well known. Yes, the amount of time before it goes off by a second. Is it, I don't know, of the order of years, or because for atomic clocks is of the order of billions of years, but for the clock on the wall, I wouldn't expect it to be more than of the order of a year before it is off by a second. So in that, from that, you could then calculate what the minimum dimension would have to be by this thing. Probably the dimension is much more than the minimum required, because it goes as d squared, but you could essentially calculate a lower bound.
What about an atomic clock, like you mentioned? Can you look at the system and see how it's doing with respect to this button?
Yes, this is actually what we would like to get after a result with autonomous clocks. At the moment, I don't know much about atomic clocks and how well they saturate these bounds. But from what I know, they do not use... They're sort of suboptimal with respect to the Heisenberg limit, because you essentially have a large collection of these atoms, and then you take an average measurement on all of them to see what the time is. So in that sense, they would not be using the quantum sort of advantage, in the sense that if you used a coherent measurement on all of them, you would do better. But probably it doesn't matter, because the dimension is already high enough there that the accuracy is good enough.
So why the fact that you have finite state is crucial? I mean, for instance, if you take a simple harmonic oscillator, would there be any bound at all?
No, so it's a very good question, actually. This is something I should have mentioned. So the motivation for why we take finite dimensions, there, so for example, there are different motivations, but the one I know the most is in thermodynamics, for instance, if you consider doing single shot operations with catalysts, and you determine what, essentially, if you consider that you have a state rho and you try to get to a state sigma, and you are allowed to use energy preserving operations as well as catalysts, then the question of whether you can take rho to sigma and what are the laws governing which states can be taken to other states depend on the constriction you put on how well the catalyst involved is returned. And the point about the scenario is that you run into the situation called embezzling, where if you just say that the catalyst has to be returned epsilon close in trace distance, epsilon is just a fixed number, then if the dimension, then you can essentially find a high enough dimension for the catalyst such that you can hide as large an amount of entropy in that system for the same epsilon change. And because of this, you could effectively cheat if you allowed infinite dimensional systems. So you would then like to constrain the dimension of your catalyst, or even if you don't constrain the dimension of catalyst, constrain the accuracy of how well the catalyst is returned as a function of the dimension. So as, if the dimension got high, you would want the catalyst to be returned even more accurately to prevent there being a possibility of cheating by using the state of the catalyst. So in this sense, the finite dimensional quantum clocks become very important, because in order to do any such single shot operation, you would need a clock to essentially, if you consider that a human being isn't doing a unitary, but instead it's a closed system and a quantum system itself is performing the unitary that will take you from rho to sigma, then that system would be a clock. And if that system is an infinite dimensional clock, it could effectively cheat by hiding a very large amount of entropy. And then you would be able to go from any state to any other state. So because of this reason, this is one reason why you would want to essentially consider finite dimensional clocks. I don't know off the top of my head any others.
So the argument you gave there seemed to be depending a lot on the idea that you reset the clock to like a fixed state, whatever it takes. Does it work for that one?
Yes. Well, so the reset model is the simpler way of looking at it, because so if you don't reset the clock, what do you have? Let me try and recall this. Sorry, I'm so used to working in the reset model for a while that I've forgotten the other argument. Well, so even, okay, so the point is, even if you, when you write the map in each step, it's going to correspond to one outcome being no tick and the other outcome being a tick. So by its very definition, even the outcome that corresponds to no tick will shift the state by some amount, because effectively you have found the state not to be in the region. With a very weak, it's a weak measurement, so the change is small, but you will have found the state not to be in that region. So which means that instead of doing the reset model, if you instead allow the state to continue evolving, every time you get a zero outcome, you still have a slight effect on the state, which is sort of equivalent of a very tiny kick. Which means that by the time it passes through the region, because you haven't reset it, the effect of having a tick in the region will be exactly the same as if you had kicked it when you reset it. But this is something that you would have to calculate and see. But the kick due to the fact that you picked one of the Krauss operators, which is corresponds to the outcome there was a tick instead of the other one, that uncertain kick is the same as if you actually reset it to the same thing. Because the reset is not actually the thing that is uncertain. It's the point at which the outcome, the Krauss operator of the outcome corresponding to tick is the one that applies to the state rather than the operator corresponding to no tick. So the fact that you reset it doesn't give you the kick. It's the channel that corresponds to the measurement outcome. And I don't know whether this explains it correctly, but maybe you can go through the calculations and see it. But the main thing to point out is that the reset, in fact, is huge, because you go from one point right to the opposite, but the kick doesn't come from the actual reset. So.
No other questions, but it's not rough again.
Thank you.